This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, and welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to learn about the ins and outs of Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, or SPACs. 2020 was a spectacular year for SPACs, if you'll pardon the pun. These so-called blank check companies raise money by issuing shares to the public and then must invest the proceeds in an operating company within a specified period of time, a transaction that helps the operating company become public without the often cumbersome process of engaging in an initial public offering. QuantumScape, which makes lithium batteries for electric cars, came public by merging with a SPAC, as did DraftKings, the online gaming company. Dozens of companies took the SPAC route to market last year and earlier this year, although the boom now looks to be cooling a bit. Barron's reporter Nicholas Jasinski has followed the SPAC market closely, and he joins me today to discuss what's next for SPACs. We'll also hear from Julian Klimochko, CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Accelerate Financial Technologies, a Canadian company that created the Accelerate Arbitrage Fund, the world's first SPAC-focused exchange-traded fund. The ticker is ARB, and it trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Welcome, Nick and Julian. I'm so glad to have you today on Barron's Live.
Hey, Lauren. Happy to be here. Happy to chat about SPACs, as always.
Super fantastic. All right, I'm going to start with Nick. SPACs have been around for decades, as you know, and they had a bad reputation in the past. So why did they suddenly grow so popular in 2020?
Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me on again.
You bet.
Yeah, so SPACs first emerged in the early 1990s, and they, like you mentioned, they were really pretty obscure vehicles for the first 20 or 25 years of their existence. I mean, a SPAC is basically, it's many things in one. It's a bit like a one company private equity or venture capital fund that raises money from a group of investors and then uses it to buy a stake in a private startup or a more mature company. But the added twist is that it's all done via a publicly traded vehicle. So a SPAC completes an IPO just like a regular company, but the cash that's raised goes into a trust where it sits earning interest. And meanwhile, the management team of the SPAC, who are called the sponsors, they're out hunting for a company that has some actual operations to merge with their SPAC. And so the SPAC investors are counting on the sponsors' deal-making ability, just like they would be counting on the portfolio manager at a private equity fund to find private deals. So the SPAC sponsors, they find the company, they agree the terms of the transaction, and after the usual merger closing process, the companies combine, and the private company takes over the SPAC's stock market listing. So for the company, it's an alternative way for them to raise capital, and also an alternative way for them to go public compared with a traditional IPO or a direct listing. And there's all kinds of complications in there with the sponsor gets a cut of the combined company as compensation. There are also warrants and PIPE investments and all kinds of other things, which we can get to later. So to answer your question, why have SPACs become so popular now? Going back to the 90s and 2000s, a lot of SPACs included terms that were very favorable to their sponsors. And they tended to be seen as a last resort for companies that wanted to go public. So in general, the deals they did weren't that successful, with a lot of dilution for shareholders, and companies that came out of SPACs really, they weren't very high quality. But in the past few years, even before 2020, you started to see more credible sponsors get involved with SPACs. And really the entire ecosystem around SPACs was maturing, which includes the law firms and the auditors that work on SPACs. All the major investment banks began underwriting SPAC IPOs, and the investor base became much broader. So it was a bit of a virtuous circle, if you will, that the better SPAC sponsors and terms attracted better investors, which attracted more quality sponsors to raise SPACs, and it continues. So before 2020, in 2019, which is when I started to write about SPACs, everybody in the whole related to SPACs was very excited because it was a record year for SPACs, and then things really just exploded in the last year in 2020.
Give us a sense of the numbers, if you would.
Sure. So the numbers are even more impressive because, as you remember, in March of last year, the IPO market and the merger market shut. The market fell into a bear market. But then SPACs really came back with a vengeance after that. So the stage was set in 2019, and then soon after the market bottomed in March last year, you had some really big name sponsors like Bill Ackman, Ray SPACs, which lifted the profile of SPACs in general. I got a cover story in Barron's. Plus, you had interest rates at practically zero, so not much opportunity cost for investors of putting some cash into a SPAC IPO. And the market just couldn't get enough of new public companies, especially growth companies. So SPACs were there to deliver that. So to give you some stats on that, these are all numbers according to SPAC Insider. Last year in 2020, 248 SPACs raised $83.3 billion in IPO proceeds, which is more than the previous 20 years combined, and about 80 announced deals. And then this year, just barely 3 months into the year, we already have 303 SPAC IPOs, which have raised $98.4 billion. So it's already a record year, just 3 months in.
But you wrote recently that the boom is cooling and that fewer SPACs are starting to file to go public and that the stock prices of SPACs that are already listed aren't climbing quite as much and some, in fact, are falling. So what's really going on here?
That's right. I'm sure Julian has some thoughts on this as well, but I think it seems that the SPAC IPO market just got ahead of itself. There are only so many dollars out there chasing SPACs. And of course, that's more dollars than there was ever before. But still, when you have so many SPAC IPOs in such a short period of time, the market needed to pause for some deals to happen to catch up to all the new IPO issuance. And at the same time, for already publicly listed SPACs, you had in the market more broadly, you had rising bond yields, which took the wind out of sales for growth stocks and more speculative stocks in general. And that included a lot of the companies that have come out of SPACs. So the already listed ones saw their share prices decline. And makes it less attractive for new sponsors to raise their SPACs. And I think it's not the end of SPACs by any means. And there's still over 500 SPACs on the market, but it's the market needs a little bit of time to digest all the SPACs that are out there already before we see some more issuance.
So the pullback in prices has left many SPACs trading at a discount to their trust value. And that opens arbitrage opportunities, something you wrote about this week on Barron's.com. So now let's bring Julian into the conversation to explain the wonderful world of SPAC arbitrage. Julian, how did you come to launch a SPAC arbitrage fund, and how does the strategy work?
Yeah, thanks, Lauren. It's great to be here, and great question. So I've been an arbitrager my entire professional career and started out about a dozen years ago in the global financial crisis, arbitraging closed-end funds and M&A, mergers and acquisitions. And SPAC arbitrage is fairly similar, but it's a simple arbitrage. So prior to getting into that, just a quick primer on how a SPAC works and some of the key characteristics that allow for this arbitrage trade to be affected. So a SPAC goes public in an IPO, say they raise $200 million, and that at $10 per unit. Notice how I said unit, not shares. Typically, they offer a unit, which includes common share plus a fraction of a warrant. So that $10 per unit goes into trust. So $200 million goes into trust where the sponsor team cannot touch it. The trust invests in short-term U.S. Treasury bills, so effectively the safest asset on the planet. And then the SPAC has 2 years to conduct a business combination, i.e. merge with a private company and bring it public. And what funds the SPAC operations, working capital, legal fees, investment bank fees, the sponsor puts up at-risk capital, typically 3% of the IPO proceeds, and the sponsor would get private placement warrants. So say in this example, the sponsor puts in $6 million to pay all the fees and fund the SPAC because the $200 million or $10 that they raise, they cannot touch. And there's a clause in every SPAC that says if they do not get a deal within 2 years, they basically liquidate. They pay back shareholders $10 plus accrued interest. And the other aspect is if they do strike a definitive agreement with a private company, then they put it up for shareholder vote. And concurrently with that vote, they allow shareholders the option to redeem for $10 plus accrued interest. So you get this baseline T-bill yield. And then in the market, especially these days, with a number of SPACs, in fact, hundreds, trading below trust value, below their net asset value, you can actually earn an additional spread. And so that's an arbitrage spread right there. If you can buy a SPAC at 990 with 1 year left, and there's $10.10 in trust, plus it continues to accrue interest, you have that arbitrage yield. It's basically buying treasuries at a discount. But there's a couple other aspects to it. So number one, if you buy units, you're getting additional value because those warrants are typically worth, call it, you know, $2 on average, and you generally get a quarter to one third of a warrant per unit. And the last driver of this arbitrage trade, and this is the best part because this is where the strategy can really pay off, is what we call upside optionality. If they announce a transaction that the market deems attractive, new market participants will come in, bid up the stock, whether it's MP Materials or DraftKings. And you see these big winners, those traded, you know, way above their $10 trust value, allowing an arbitrager to exit at $12, $13, $15, sometimes north of $20 per share, recycle those proceeds into new issues at or below $10. So we like the trade because it has an extremely low risk profile. If you're buying a SPAC at a discount, you're virtually guaranteed not to lose money as long as you're not forced to sell in the meantime, as long as you can hold to maturity. And then some of them have tremendous upside optionality, where we actually held Churchill Capital SPAC, CCIV, and that was a record because it traded north of $60 prior to closing, and we actually sold some up there, which is pretty exceptional, but, you know, completely unrealistic. You know, if we can exit at $12, $13, $15, get a 20 to 50% return with very mitigated downside, that's a tremendous risk-reward proposition. I call it heads we win, tails we win big, or basically, you know, the risk of T-bills, be it illiquid T-bills, with equity-like upside. So it's a cool asset class. If you put together a diversified portfolio of SPAC arbitrage opportunities, you do have that downside protection combined with this tremendous upside potential. And, you know, in general, we find that these SPAC portfolios are uncorrelated with traditional asset classes. So interesting strategy, but I do need to put out a disclaimer out there. I consider this strategy simple, but not easy. Right? Because, you know, it's simple to understand, buy at 990, sell, you know, worse at 10 and change, hopefully higher. But to administer this, you know, it's a tremendous amount of work. You got to follow every single filing. There's currently 553 SPACs. The best way to pursue this strategy is a diversified portfolio, because ultimately, you never know which SPAC will really hit with a transaction that works. It could be a very low profile sponsor that no one's ever, like a first time sponsor that no one's really ever heard of, or it could be a high profile sponsor and this is their eighth SPAC. You never really know. Certainly there's a bit of correlation with sponsor reputation and credibility, which I'll get into with some picks later on. But it certainly requires that diversification. And from an administrative standpoint, where I do see investors end up losing money on the strategy is if they buy us back at a discount and miss the redemption date, and then that effective embedded put option disappears. They end up losing money and saying, hey, why is this trading at $8? Well, they missed the redemption date. Like I said, it requires you to be up to speed, following it on a full-time basis, and really keeping track of everything that's involved, because this is a labor-intensive strategy.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned all that, because in the first part of your answer, it was starting to sound like free money. And I was wondering, you know, there's no free lunch for anyone. What could possibly be the downside here?
Yeah. And so there is, quote unquote, free money. We ran the numbers last week, and that totaled north of $1 billion in terms of trading prices and the discount representing versus the underlying net asset values. So it is there, but it is there for enterprising investors willing to do the work. It's not like buying, set it and forget it, buying the S&P 500 and you're good. You know, this is the type of strategy that requires quite a bit of elbow grease, quite a bit of attention being paid. And we got a full-time team doing this, tracking every single filing, reading every single filing, tracking the net asset values of all 553 SPACs. And you know, we affect this strategy in our Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF, own over 200 SPACs. And me personally, you know, I've analyzed 600 to 700 and invested in over 300. So I know the market fairly well, and you kind of get a sense of what to pay attention to and certain red flags and pitfalls to be wary of.
So let's talk about maybe a couple of names that you think look particularly attractive from an arbitrage perspective.
Sure, will do. And so where we are seeing the best opportunity in the market, and to expand on Nick's comment, where the SPAC IPO market really just got overheated. There is way too much issuance and the market couldn't keep up. It got oversupplied and new issues traded down. So we're seeing a really interesting dynamic in that the discounts are heavily concentrated on fresh SPACs, newly issued SPACs, ones that were issued in the past month or two. So I did want to mention a number of SPAC units. And so this is basically the common shares and warrant stapled into a unit that were just issued. And I'm focused on sponsors that have a lot of credibility and good reputation and good deal flow. So sponsors that aren't first-time SPAC issuers, these have been around the block and have done a number of deals already. So the first one, Landcadia Holdings 4 unit. So this is LCAHU is the symbol. And I should mention all these recommendations, number one, based on price. We're talking about, you know, this free money opportunity where you can buy these at or below $10. Landcadia Holdings 4 was trading at $9.95. And this is a good sponsor team. For example, they did the Golden Nugget deal. That was a big winner for us last year. They also did the Hillman deal and their other SPAC, which, you know, wasn't the best deal. But, you know, as long as they get something done and you can monetize the warrants, that can still be a good proposition. Because, for example, these warrants add a lot of value in this. In the case where they announce a deal and it doesn't trade above net asset value and you need to redeem your shares, sometimes those warrants have significant value such that those warrants alone can generate a 6 to 8% return for the unit investor. So it's important that investors keep that in mind. So Landcadia Holdings 4 is one pick. Another one, Forum Merger 4. So this IPO'd March 18th, the symbol is FMIVU, trading around $10 per unit. And that unit comes with a quarter warrant, as did the Landcadia one. So Forum, this sponsored team, did the Tattooed Chef, which was a big winner last year. This is their fourth SPAC. Another pick I have, Fortress Value Acquisition 4. This one IPO'd March 16th. The units are trading under FVIV/U, also around $10 per unit. You get 1/8 of a warrant, so a bit less warrant coverage on this one. This was a team that put together the MP Materials deal last year, which is trading around $35 a share. So a big winner on that one. Another one is CF Acquisition 8. Believe it or not, this is their eighth SPAC from the Cantor Fitzgerald team. This IPO'd March 12th. The units are at about $10 per unit. Each unit contains a quarter warrant, so you get that warrant upside. And this team, they've had kind of a mixed track record. They did GCM, they did View, which haven't been huge winners, but you know, it's important to note that, you know, this investment bank gets good deal flow, not just good deal flow for a business combination, but with most, if not all, business combinations these days, we're seeing concurrent pipe financings, which are an important aspect to a successful deal. And you got to be confident that the sponsor can help raise that. The last pick I'm going to go with, now this is a warrantless SPAC. They IPO'd just common shares. This is Vector Acquisition 2, symbol VAQC, IPO'd March 11th, trading at a discount, roughly $9.96. So no warrants on this one. This is a tech-focused SPAC. their first one, their first SPAC. They did the Rocket Lab deal, which has been well received thus far. So those are five picks where you can really affect that arbitrage opportunity. And we're focused on pre-deal SPACs because then you have that upside optionality. If they announce a winning deal, you also get the warrants in four out of five of them, plus a credible sponsor team who's done this before such that you can have confidence that they will be successful in terms of their search. Because with 553 SPACs out there and 429 searching for a deal, it's competitive out there. I'm sure a lot of sponsors, especially those with not great networks, will be stuck with no dance partner and have to liquidate. And liquidate, you get back $10 plus accrued interest. But in that case, your warrants are worthless. So your return will be like 1% or lower. So that's not really what we're in it for. We want to see them getting deals done and getting exposure to that upside optionality and monetizing those warrants.
So not to interject a somewhat discordant note, but what's interesting to me, the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that the acting director of the SEC's corporate finance division warned at a legal conference about what he called some significant and yet undiscovered issues regarding SPACs. And people have said that the Biden administration is likely to take a harder look at this funding mechanism than perhaps the Trump administration did. So where do you think this is leading, Julian, and does it concern you at all?
Well, we got to look at, number one, what's the purpose of a SPAC? And that's really capital formation to foster business, foster entrepreneurship, and grow businesses. Ultimately, these are the companies that are going public by SPAC are growth companies looking to invest in the economy. So I think ultimately it's a good thing. It's a great thing for investors because if you're bullish or bearish, if you're bullish, you have more opportunities for going long. And if you're bearish, you have more opportunities to short. And so one major risk to markets that emerged over the past 20 years was a dramatic decline in public market listings. And that serves no one any benefit when you have listings decline from like 8,000 to 5,000. That's a bad thing because investors have less choice, right? And so to the extent that we can reverse that declining trend, I think that's super positive. Now, this is an asset class that really has been worked on. And I don't know if perfected is the right word, but it's certainly become significantly more improved such that there's a template that works. Like the disclosures are significant. I think one thing that attention is being paid to has been the fact that when a private company goes public by SPAC, they do provide forecasts and forward-looking statements that aren't allowed within the S-1 of a traditional IPO. But in my opinion, the more disclosure, the better. So would they want to have less disclosure with respect to forecasts? It's tough to say. I don't really know where the threat is or exactly what the SEC can do. Typically, you don't see the SEC do much in these scenarios. They are making some noise, perhaps to try to verbally help cool the market or try to get the market to self-regulate itself. And it kind of does that on its own, right? We discussed this massive slowdown in supply because there was a demand response to that supply, right? So the market got flooded. It's now hopefully going to shrink because there's just insufficient capital to soak up all the SPACs out there. So ultimately, who knows? That's all just speculation on my part. I haven't heard them talk about anything specific that is negative within a SPAC structure. I think it works. And ultimately, you look at it from a high-level view, it's in fact a very, very low-risk investment, as long, and this is very important, as long as you're buying at the right price. Where I saw investors burned is when, they'd buy pre-deal SPACs at, massive premiums to the net asset value, $12, $13, when these things have $10 in cash per share. So don't do that. And investors,
it's like any investment, it's the quality of the investment and the level of the price.
Yeah, exactly. That's
for sure. So one quick question for Nick, and then we're going to go to some listener questions. We've got quite a few. Nick, you've written a lot in the past about the proliferation of celebrities getting involved in SPACs, and this tends to cause a lot of buzz, but is it a good thing or is it a red flag, or do you think it can be both?
That's a good way to put it. I think it can be both. I think it depends on the involvement of the celebrity in the SPAC. Often it's almost like a marketing tool that the SPAC goes public and its sponsors are somebody with a financial background or previous public company background, and they have as a special advisor to the SPAC somebody like Shaquille O'Neal or a celebrity from something else. And I think that maybe can open the door with some target companies and certainly raises the profile of the SPAC, but it's not like Shaq is going to be doing the due diligence and constructing the financial models and all that for the SPAC. In general, I mean, it's tough evaluating SPAC sponsors because it's an inherently qualitative process. You can't really put numbers on it. So just a few things that, in my opinion, I look at, like Julian mentioned, the sponsor's track record with previous SPACs. It's very easy to raise a SPAC IPO, but you should look at how the company that their previous SPAC merged with, how the stock performed after the merger. So that's a pretty good indicator of their deal-making ability, but also their ability to judge what makes an attractive target company. Look at how the sponsors are compensated. Is their compensation more, are they incentivized just to close a deal, any deal, or are they aligned with shareholders and paid relative to how the stock performed? And then there's a few other things like sponsors. I always like sponsors that have some sort of operating experience, because the SPAC often gets a couple board seats after the merger, so they're involved after the deal closes, and having a former public company executive to guide a founder of a newly public company can be helpful. Also SPACs that have some sort of institutional backing, so it's not just some dude who goes out and raises an IPO, but it's Julian mentioned FEAC4, that's backed by Fortress Investment Group, the private equity firm. TPG, Goldman Sachs, Bill Ackman all have SPACs out there, and they certainly have access to better deal flow, to use the lingo, but also ability to attract investors to the SPAC. So it's a little bit of a fluffy process, but in general, look at track records and think about, is this somebody who you'd be comfortable entrusting your money to? Because that's essentially what you're doing. They're making the investment decision for you when you buy the shares in the SPAC.
Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned all of that. So we have a question from James, and I'll put this to Julian. Historically, what percentage of SPACs have liquidated without closing a deal? And do you expect that number to increase in the future with the surge in new SPAC issuance?
So last year, there were two that liquidated. So that was like less than 1%. Historically, it's been roughly 8%. And in terms on a go-forward basis, with currently 429 looking for a deal, on a percent basis, you know, I don't necessarily think it'll be more than what we've seen historically. However, we're going to have a lot more than two. Maybe not this year, but, you know, when the rubber hits the road next year, a bunch of SPACs will start hitting their deadline without a deal. So, yeah, I do expect that to increase, especially with the frenzy over, because in January and February, basically every SPAC was trading at a premium. So if it approached its deadline, they could just put it up to vote to extend because no one wanted to redeem because it was at a premium. So they could just continuously extend their deadline. However, with most of them trading at a discount now as the deadline approaches, in order to extend that deadline, it's got to be put to shareholder vote. And concurrently with the vote, they need to offer that redemption privilege. So I think we'll see a lot more being redeemed as opposed to extended. And if they get overwhelmed by redemptions, then they will liquidate. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see, call it, you know, there's 400, over 400 out there, 429. So if we saw 40 liquidate, I don't think I'd be surprised.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, something like 75% of the SPACs ever raised have been raised in the past 12 months. So unfortunately, a lot of the historical statistics are hard to spin forward, just because the history of the SPAC asset class is really going to be written over the next couple of years, just by the fact that so many of them are, so much of all the SPACs to ever exist have gone public just now.
that's a good point. So William asks, with over $100 billion in SPACs now, how are new SPACs differentiating themselves to seem attractive given the large amount of options available for investors? Julian, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so there's about $200 billion out there. And investors got to remember that, you know, it's still a very small asset class, even though it's up 10x year over year. Last year it was $20 billion, now it's $200 billion. It's still a small fraction of the $3 trillion in private equity, $2.5 trillion in hedge funds, and, you know, $1 trillion odd in venture capital. So SPACs are still very small. It's just that there's a lot of them because the average one is about $318 million. So they're all kind of like microcaps for the most part. As for new issuance, and so what we do in our ETF is, besides buying in the secondary market at a discount, we do subscribe to SPAC IPOs as well. Got that good deal flow with underwriters. And one that we did subscribe to, there's only been four SPAC IPOs this month. One was CM Life Sciences 3, which, despite the bear market, this was a heavily oversubscribed issue because this is a team that does, they're focused on life sciences, biotech, and they've had tremendous success from their first two, which we also invested in. So it was heavily oversubscribed. Luckily, we got a small allocation, and it came out of the gate at a 10% premium. So I think, you know, the cream rises to the top. You'll always have top quality sponsors able to launch a SPAC. That's not going to change. Sponsors that it's not their first. But even if you're someone like KKR, which issued their first last month, firms like that with that credibility, that brand name, they're still going to be able to. We did see some smaller niche SPACs come to market, and what they offer, they got to offer more kickers to investors. So number one is higher warrant coverage. Some of these firms are offering half a warrant to a full warrant, just giving more of that upside to investors. There's one SPAC IPO today. They offered additional rights, and there's another lever they can pull, and this is called an overfunded trust, where the sponsor puts more money into trust such that the SPAC starts out with a NAV at $10.10, $10.20. So to entice an investor to subscribe to the IPO at $10, the NAV is already, you know, up 1% to 2%. And those are the types of things that are required to be successful in the current market environment.
So this is the last question we have time for, and I'll pose it to both of you. As Nick said, the history of SPACs as an asset class will be written over the next few years. So Harry asks, given the sheer volume of SPACs and the recent downdraft in valuations, how do you expect the market to evolve? Nick, give me your answer, then we'll go to Julian, and then we'll call it a day.
I think we touched on a few of those points before, but I mean, I think just in the very near term, you're going to see some separation between the higher quality SPACs and the less credible ones, in just how their share prices perform. But also, going forward in the IPO market, I think the higher quality ones will be able to have more attractive IPO terms and outcompete there, and then on the back end outcompete some of the lower quality SPACs for doing deals. So I think the what we're going to be seeing in the near term is more separation of the wheat from the chaff in the SPAC market.
Makes sense. What do you think, Julian?
So it's important to keep in mind that this is a market which is highly cyclical. We go through these cycles constantly. I've seen like four over the past year. Last spring, with respect to the pandemic flaring a big bear market, issuance got cut off, the IPO window closed, and then it took a while for the market to get its legs back. Everything was at a discount in March and April, and then went into a bull market in the summer. Market got saturated with IPOs. Come late July, things softened, lots traded to a discount, then turned into another bull market into the fall. At a bear market in October, or more of a correction, such that a lot were trading at discounts. The IPO issuance got cut off. It was driven by oversupply, aggressive underwriting, etc. Then we had a bull market into February, and then March, another bear market. So it's highly cyclical. And investors need to be cognizant of that. I remember in January and February, I was warning investors, be like, look, don't pay 20 to 30% premiums for pre-deal SPACs. That's just insane. And at the time, people thought when things were up that they'd never go down again. And now we hit a bear market and investors think, oh, it's terrible. SPACs are awful. When things are bad, things will always be bad and never get good again. But I think in both cases, sentiment changes quickly. Investors have short memories. And the thing that I always remember is this market is highly cyclical. And yes, we'll have lots of bull markets and bear markets in the future. And that's really just characteristic of the SPAC market.
Okay, one more question I want to sneak in, and then we will bring it to a close. Leo asks, what do you think is the most crowded part of the SPAC market in relation to potential targets? Is it U.S. tech? Is it something else? And is there a niche that you would avoid? If you could just give me a minute on that.
Yeah, sure, I can start. And okay. So certainly with, technology, like the really early stage pre-revenue or pre-profit and pre-revenue deals, like those aren't working anymore. The market has become more skeptical and more wanting on valuations. I think if you could do a private round at $1 billion and then 6 months later do a SPAC at $2 to $3 billion, those days are over and those deals aren't being treated well. Like, I think to have a winning deal in the current market, you need to have solid near-term fundamentals, revenue, EBITDA, hopefully, free cash flow with tremendous upside growth as well. So I call it more of a GARP type investment. Those are the SPACs that are working in the current market. So growth, but with solid current fundamental valuations, not where, you're valuing it off 2026 numbers. I think the market's much more skeptical on those. So that the EV space and that, that sort of space has really cooled, I think. And I think that's one sector of the market where there's just so much supply because it was so hot. That sentiment has really turned on it. And I think we're going to be seeing fewer and fewer of those types of transactions.
Well, I like that idea that we looking out to 2026 numbers is a long time to wait for a reward. So I think we'll end it there. Thank you very much, Julian. And thank you so much, Nick. And keep up the good work following the SPAC market.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Please come back tomorrow when Jackie Vanderbrug, Head of Sustainable and Impact Investment Strategy for Bank of America's Chief Investment Office, will speak with Abby Schultz, a senior writer at Barron's Penta, about sustainable investment options throughout the public and private markets. Thanks again, Julian and Nick, and our listeners. There's a lot more to say about SPACs. Perhaps we'll schedule a second call. Until then, everyone, be well and have a good day.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.